Florence, a Renaissance walk. As home of the Renaissance and birthplace of the modern urban lifestyle, you could call Florence Europe's cultural capital. Hi, I'm Rick Steves. Thanks for joining me on a walk through the heart of Renaissance Florence. We'll admire the soaring church dome that symbolizes the proud Renaissance spirit. We'll see the bronze doors that opened up the Renaissance and walk the same narrow streets as Michelangelo and the Medici. Be aware that many of Florence's sites have erratic opening hours. Some others require a reservation, and still others have long lines where reservations are a good idea. Get a good guidebook to help maximize your sightseeing time. Now, allow around an hour for this mile-long walk as we see the Florence of the Renaissance and the vibrant, trendy city of today. To help us along the way, I've invited a good friend and virtual travel buddy. Welcome, Lisa.
Buongiorno, Rick.
Lisa will give us helpful directions and sightseeing tips throughout the tour.
And my first tip is to be sure you get our tour updates. Just press the icon at the lower right of your device. You'll find any updates and helpful instructions unique to this tour.
Things like closures, opening hours, and reservation requirements.
There's also tips on how to use this audio tour and even the full printed script.
Yes, so pause for just a moment right now to review our updates and special tips.
It's okay, we'll wait.
And now, let's go on a Renaissance walk. The tour begins. The Duomo.
Start at the Duomo, or main cathedral, with its distinctive red dome. The Duomo is the center of Florence and the orientation point for this walk.
If you ever get lost, home's the dome.
We'll start at the dome, see several sites in the area, then stroll down the city's pedestrian-only main street to the Palazzo Vecchio and the Arno River. The square in front of the Duomo is always lively with tourists. Give yourself a few minutes to just walk around and take it all in, while Rick introduces us to Florence and the Renaissance.
You're standing at ground zero of that cultural explosion we call the Florentine Renaissance. Wow! Marvel at this incredible church. Admire the Duomo's colorful facade of green, white, and pink marble. Appreciate the cathedral's sheer massiveness. It's about 500 feet long. It makes the top 10 list of largest churches in the world. And capping it all is the distinctive red and white ribbed dome by Filippo Brunelleschi. Just to the right of the church is its colorful bell tower, or campanile. And the octagonal building, just across the way facing the Duomo, is called the baptistry. The Duomo, a medieval church topped with a Renaissance dome, is the perfect place to talk about how medieval Florence became the birthplace of the Renaissance. By the year 1300, while much of Europe was still mired in poverty and ignorance, Florence had become a powerful center of banking, trading, and clothmaking. They were rich, and that wealth fertilized the cultural soil. Florence practiced the art of civilized living, while the rest of Europe was still wearing hand-me-down leotards. Meanwhile, their cathedral just didn't match their upwardly mobile society. In medieval times, the baptistry had served as the main worship site. The Duomo was just a small, humble church standing alongside. Then, in 1296, the cornerstone was laid for a huge church, today's Duomo. It was intended to be the biggest church in Christendom, and very nearly was. The architect, Arnolfo di Cambio, built a colossal structure of brick and then faced it with a colorful marble veneer.
Now, find a spot with a good view of the Duomo's facade.
The facade is certainly colorful, the pink, white, and green marble, three stories tall, with pointed Gothic arches, studded with statues, and gleaming with gold mosaics. In the center of the facade, above the central door and below the circular window, is a statue in a niche of Mary and baby Jesus. The church is officially named for her, Santa Maria del Fiore, Saint Mary of the Flower. But most people just call the church the Duomo, the Italian word for cathedral. It comes from the Latin word domus, as in domicile or house of God. The facade is impressive, but it's not old. You see, Arnolfo di Cambio's facade was under construction for nearly three centuries, from 1296 until 1587, but it was never finished. It wasn't until the 19th century that the current neo-Gothic facade was added. Thankfully, the neo-Gothic design fits. It looks similar to the original vision. Still, the facade is generally ridiculed. It was rushed to completion to celebrate Italian unity here in a city that for a few years served as the country's capital. Some call the church the Cathedral in Pajamas.
Hey, I like it. Now, start heading toward the church's bell tower, or campanile, for a closer look.
By the way, if you go inside the Duomo, we won't on this walk, the interior is big, bare, and a bit disappointing. From the inside, Brunelleschi's dome is shallow, much lower than the exterior dome, and unimaginatively painted with a Last Judgment by Giorgio Vasari.
I happen to like Vasari's Last Judgment.
You would. You're fired.
Okay, but without me, you'd get lost.
That's true. Okay, you're not fired.
By now, you should have a good view of the campanile and the statues that decorate it.
The bell tower. The church's bell tower, or campanile, to the right of the facade, is 270 feet tall and multicolored like the Duomo. Like the church, it served as a sculpture gallery for Renaissance artists. Notice Donatello's four prophets on the side that faces out. These are copies. The originals are in the wonderful Duomo Museum, located just behind the church. There you'll also find a wooden model of Brunelleschi's dome, Ghiberti's baptistry doors, and a late Pietà by Michelangelo. The bell tower is known as Giotto's Tower because he designed it back in the 1300s. Though Giotto lived two centuries before the age of Michelangelo, he's considered the father of Renaissance painting. In his day, Giotto was called the ugliest man to ever walk the streets of Florence. But he left the city what, in our day, many call the most beautiful bell tower in all of Europe. As you admire Giotto's glorious tower, you can appreciate how much more enlightened the Florentines already were compared to the rest of Europe in the 1300s. By contrast, in medieval times, poverty and ignorance made life, for lack of a better cliché, nasty, brutish, and short. If ever the church was the opiate of the masses, it was in medieval times. Life was only a preparation for a happier time in heaven after leaving this miserable earthly existence. Medieval art was the church's servant. Its purpose? To embellish the house of God. Painting and sculpture were often crude, only realistic enough to tell Bible stories for the devout and illiterate masses. But while the rest of Europe was mired in medievalism, in Florence, prosperity was rising, and so was people's confidence in life and in themselves. Rather than being at the whim of nature, middle-class craftsmen, salesmen, and bankers felt they could control their own destinies. They found much in common with the ancient Greeks and Romans, who valued logic and reason above superstition and blind faith. Then in 1348 came the bubonic plague, the Black Death, killing nearly half the city's population. As Florence recovered, the infrastructure was still intact, and the city rebuilt better than ever. Led by Florence's chief family, the art-crazy Medici, and with the naturally aggressive and creative spirit of the Florentines, it's no wonder the long-awaited Renaissance finally took root right here.
Which brings us to the next stage in the Duomo's story, the dome. For the best views of the dome, start heading to the right of the church and the bell tower.
That's right. The best place to view the dome is at the corner of the pedestrian-only street.
Find yourself a spot.
Somewhere where you won't get trampled by all the crowds.
And gaze up at what has become the symbol of Florence, the dome.
Brunelleschi's Dome. The dome of the Florence Cathedral, visible from all over the city, inspired Florentines to do great things. The church itself had been started in the 13th century, but it was left unfinished with a big hole in the roof. Those medieval people didn't have the technology yet to span it with a dome. No problema. They built it anyway, knowing that someday someone could handle the challenge. In the 1400s, the architect Filippo Brunelleschi was called on to finish the job. Brunelleschi traveled to Rome. He studied the ancient domed Pantheon, did the math, then returned to cap the church Roman style, with a tall, self-supporting dome as grand as the ancients could build. He used a dome-within-a-dome design. First, he built the grand white skeletal ribs, which we can see. Then, he filled them in with interlocking bricks in a herringbone pattern. The dome grew upward like an igloo, supporting itself as it proceeded from the base. When they approached the top, Brunelleschi arched the ribs in and fixed them in place with the lantern. His dome, built in only 14 years, was the largest in 1,000 years. Brunelleschi's dome was the wonder of the age, the model for many domes to follow, from St. Peter's in Rome to the Capitol in Washington, D.C. People gave it the ultimate compliment, saying, "Not even the ancients could have done it." Michelangelo, setting out to construct the dome of St. Peter's, drew inspiration from the dome of Florence. He said, "I'll make its sister, bigger, but not more beautiful." Brunelleschi's dome also symbolizes the confidence of the Florentines, who rose from medieval roots to kick off the Renaissance.
Rick, as we look at the dome, tell us a little more about the Renaissance.
Sure. The Renaissance was a cultural movement that energized Europe from around 1400 until 1550. The word Renaissance means rebirth, the rebirth of Greek and Roman culture that had been lost for 1,000 years after the fall of Rome. It started first in Florence around 1400, and over the next 150 years, the Renaissance swept through Italy, across Europe, and beyond. In politics, the Renaissance meant democracy. In science, a renewed interest in exploring nature. This was the age of Columbus and the discovery of new lands and people. In religion, it spawned the Protestant Reformation. In literature, timeless works were written in local languages, like Italian. The general mood was optimistic and humanistic, with a confidence in the power of the individual. Now glance back over at the church's facade. Gothic, or actually neo-Gothic, with pointed arches. Compare this with Brunelleschi's groundbreaking Renaissance dome. Renaissance art was a return to the realism and balance of Greek and Roman statues and buildings. They built with classical domes and round arches instead of Gothic spires and pointed arches. In painting and sculpture, Renaissance artists strove for lifelike realism. Merging art and science, they used mathematics, the laws of perspective, and direct observation of nature to try to capture the three-dimensional world on a two-dimensional surface. While it was a logical and scientific age, the Renaissance was not an anti-Christian movement. Artists saw themselves as an extension of God's creative powers. For them, the best way to glorify God was not to bow down in church, but to recognize the talents God gave them and use them. At times, the church even supported the Renaissance. The Duomo hired Florence's best artists to decorate the church inside and out. In fact, Michelangelo's David was originally meant to stand atop the cathedral. But also, for the first time in Europe since Roman days, we find wealthy private citizens who wanted art simply for the sake of art. After 1,000 years of waiting, the smoldering fires of Europe's classical heritage burst into flame right here in Florence.
Let's go see what some call the very first Renaissance work. Start making your way over to the baptistry. We're headed for the far or north side of the building. In fact, it might be helpful to get oriented to the compass points. The Duomo is aligned east-west with the main entrance at the west end. So north is to the left as you face the Duomo, and the Arno River is about 10 minutes south of here. At some point, you may want to climb Brunelleschi's dome for great views over the red-tiled roofs of Florence.
Giotto's tower, on the other hand, offers an easier, less crowded, and faster climb than the Duomo's dome. But climbing the dome lets you actually hike up between Brunelleschi's two domes, and the unobstructed views from the Duomo are better.
Now turn your attention to the baptistry, the octagonal building in front of the church. Most of the tourists are probably crowding around the big bronze doors on the side that faces the Duomo. We'll see these famous Gates of Paradise by Ghiberti in a minute. But first, make your way around to the right to the north side of the baptistry, where you'll find another set of bronze doors, also by Ghiberti.
The Baptistry and Ghiberti's Bronze Doors. Florence's baptistry is dear to the soul of the city. Traditionally, festivals and parades either started or ended here. In medieval and Renaissance times, the locals, eager to link themselves to the classical past, believed that this was an ancient Roman building. It wasn't, but it is Florence's oldest building, nearly 1,000 years old. While we're not going there on this tour, if you pay to go inside, you'll see some great pre-Renaissance mosaics. On the ceiling is a dramatic Last Judgment featuring a hellish scene like something right out of the Inferno by Dante, who, by the way, was dipped into the baptismal waters right here.
By now, you should be on the side of the baptistry with Ghiberti's less famous but equally important doors.
On the north side of the baptistry are a set of bronze doors that bring us out of the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance. In fact, some say the Renaissance began precisely in the year 1401, when Florence staged a competition to find the best artist to create this set of doors. Florence had a strong civic spirit, with different guilds or business associations proudly embellishing their city with great art. All the greats entered the contest, including Brunelleschi. Brunelleschi lost the baptistry gig, freeing him up to later design the cathedral's dome. The clear winner was 25-year-old Lorenzo Ghiberti, who set about casting bronze doors for the north entrance. With the panels, Ghiberti told the entire story of Christ in just a few dramatic episodes.
Start by checking out the panels at about eye level. So that'd be the third row from the bottom.
Read the panels left to right as Jesus' story begins. On the left is the Annunciation, where an angel comes to tell Mary she'll be having a baby.
And she'll definitely be needing a bigger house.
The next panel to the right shows baby Jesus.
Yeah, now I see him. He's tucked underneath Mary, who's sleeping.
In the next panel, the three wise men come to worship him, and so on. The story winds all the way up to the top of the doors with Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection.
Personally, I like the scenes near the bottom, like the second row from the bottom showing the four gospel writers.
On the left, there's John with his symbolic eagle. Then it's Matthew being visited by an angel. Then Luke.
Just chillin'.
And finally, Mark with his winged lion.
Ghiberti sure was talented.
And his self-portrait is here. It's just above eye level, in the center of the door. That tiny head on the left, that's Ghiberti. And his son is on the right.
Nice turbans.
These north doors were revolutionary for the time. But frankly, the figures are kind of small. And there's no real backdrop to the scenes. It's just people on a blank background.
Then, let's see Ghiberti's next work. Those famous east doors. Start circling around to the east side of the baptistry, to the impressive doors that face the church.
We're headed for the project Ghiberti did next, and by then, he'd learned a lot. He'd studied the laws of perspective, the same rules painters use to create three-dimensional scenes on a two-dimensional surface. And with this project, Ghiberti pioneered new frontiers in art.
Find a place to take in the baptistry doors that face the cathedral.
By the way, these are copies. The originals are in that fascinating Duomo Museum behind the church.
Now, let's see the doors, the so-called Gates of Paradise.
In 1425, Ghiberti was given another commission for these east doors. This time, there was literally no contest. The bronze panels of these doors added a whole new dimension to art, depth. Michelangelo said the doors were fit to be the gates of paradise, and they revolutionized the way Renaissance people saw the world around them. The doors are made of 10 rectangular panels, each with a scene from the Bible. Direct your gaze to just above eye level to the two panels midway up the doors. In the Jacob and Esau panel on the left, the scene is set under a series of arches. The arches appear to recede into the distance, and so do the floor tiles and banisters, creating a 3D background for a realistic scene. The figures in the foreground stand and move like real people, telling the Bible story with human details. Notice how the illusion of 3D works. The people closest to us are big, well-defined, and placed at the bottom of the panel. The more distant figures are smaller, fuzzier, and higher up in the picture plane. At the center of the panel is the so-called vanishing point, the spot on the distant horizon where all the arches and floor tiles converge.
Pretty nifty. Now let's turn to another scene.
The panel to the right, Joseph and Benjamin, features a temple in the round, inhabited by workers. Amazingly, this spacious three-dimensional scene is made from bronze only a few inches deep. The subconscious feeling it leaves you with is of a space that's light and airy, though it's crowded with intricate details, people in flowing robes, bags of goods, and workers bustling here and there. Everything is orderly and symmetrical. Ghiberti captured the perfect world created by God that people of the Renaissance felt blessed to live in. Here we see how the Renaissance was a merging of art and science. Realism was in, and Renaissance artists used math, illusion, and even dissection to achieve it. Ghiberti's work inspired the next generation of artists to create three-dimensional paintings on a two-dimensional surface.
As you peruse the artistry of the panels, also think of the workmanship.
The doors were a major manufacturing job, requiring different artists and artisans for each stage. Some prepared the wax models used to cast the bronze panels. After they were cast, the panels had to be polished. They were painted with a solution of powdered gold, then heated to bake it on. Meanwhile, other workers were creating the structural door frame that holds the panels. Ghiberti oversaw it all. He was not only an artist, but a shrewd businessman who hired great artists to collaborate with him.
Including an up-and-coming sculptor named Donatello.
Ghiberti designed the panels, hired the workers, signed the paychecks, and saw it through to the end.
He spent 27 years on the project, and at the end, he once again included his self-portrait. That's him in the center of the doorframe, atop the second row of panels.
Of the two small heads, he's the one on the left.
He looks a bit older now.
Right, though now with a shiny head of male pattern baldness, Ghiberti had helped launch the Renaissance.
Leave the Duomo going south past Giotto's Tower and enter the pedestrian-only street that runs from here toward the Arno River. This main pedestrian drag through old Florence is called Via dei Calzaioli.
Calzaioli. Say it three times fast. Calzaioli, Calzaioli, Calzaioli.
Man, you're good. Once you reach Via dei
Calzaioli,
whatever, the pedestrian street, start the next track and stroll down the street.
Slowly. Don't be in a Firenze to get anywhere.
Ha ha.
Firenze.
Ultimately, we're headed for the Or San Michele Church, about 200 yards down. But let Rick show you a few sights along the way.
Along Via dei Calzaioli.
Show off.
Via dei Calzaioli. This pedestrian-only street has been Florence's main drag for a couple thousand years. It got its start as part of the ancient grid plan of the Roman colony that became Florence. In Renaissance times, it connected the religious center, the Duomo, with the political center, where we're headed now, a five-minute walk away. In the last generation, traffic jams have been replaced by potted plants, and now this is a pleasant place to stroll. It's lined with trendy boutiques showcasing the latest fashions. Florence has been known for its sense of style since the days when the Medici made striped tights all the rage in Europe. It's a great place to window shop, people watch, catch the drips on your gelato cone, and wonder why American cities just can't become more pedestrian-friendly. And speaking of gelato, there are several fine gelaterias along this walk. Gelato, Italian-style ice cream, is considered the best in the world, and Italy's best is right here in Florence. Think of it as edible art, a souvenir that can't break and won't clutter your luggage. Gelato is made with less milk fat than American ice cream, so the natural flavors come through. If it's displayed in metal tins rather than plastic, it probably means it's homemade, right on the premises. You'll find some very exotic flavors. Ask for a taste. Un assaggio, per favore? That means a taste, please. To choose flavors that go well together, ask what marries well. Che si sposano bene.
When you reach the next intersection, stop.
Stop for gelato?
No, but something just as good. Florence's Ancient Origins.
Oh. Well, is it good for me?
Definitely.
Then lead on, signora.
Keep going down the street until you reach an intersection where you can look to the right and see a huge triumphal arch.
An arch like the kind the ancient Romans built?
Exactly.
Back when the Romans invented gelato?
Oh, brother. By now, you should be nearing that intersection with Via degli Speziali. Stop here, look to the right, and take in that triumphal arch. Between you and the arch stands a column with a statue on top.
The huge triumphal arch marks the place that, in Roman times, was the forum, or city center. The lone column, nicknamed the belly button of Florence, once marked the intersection of the two main Roman roads. All that survives of Roman Florence is its grid street plan and this column. The triumphal arch frames the Piazza Repubblica. The arch and the square both date from around 1870, built to celebrate the unification of Italy, when, for a brief time, Florence was the new country's capital. Today, venerable cafes and stores line the square, and at night, this is a great place to hang out and watch the world go by.
Continue your stroll down Via dei Calzaiuole. As you peruse the various shops, remember that this has been one of Florence's main shopping streets for centuries. In times past, each block was designated for different businesses: cheese merchants, flag makers, bridal makers, painters, and so on.
You're right in the heart of what was Renaissance Florence. The poet Dante lived just a couple of blocks to the left. The police station was also near here. It's now known as the Bargello Museum, with statues by Michelangelo and Donatello. Now, just for fun, mentally replace all these tourists in shorts with Florentines in Renaissance clothing. The men wore colorful Romeo-style tights, with swords in their belts and caps with a feather in it. The women wore Juliet-style dresses with poofy sleeves and brocaded patterns and hairnets. And to picture yourself back in Florence at the beginning of the Renaissance in 1400, there's no better place than at the Or San Michele Church.
When you reach the intersection, on the right stands a rough stone building ringed with statues in niches, the Church of Or San Michele.
The Or San Michele Church exterior. The Or San Michele Church is a combination church and granary. Originally, it was built as an open loggia, or covered porch. Shoppers could come and go through the open arches, shopping for grain that was stored upstairs in a huge warehouse. They could also worship here, at a painting of the Virgin Mary that stood inside. In the 14th century, the arches were filled in, and the building gained a new purpose, as a church. This was prime real estate on what had become the main drag between the Duomo and the town hall. Over time, the 14 niches around the outside were filled in with statues, sponsored not by the church, but by the rising middle class of merchants. They commissioned statues as PR gestures, hiring the finest artists of the generation. Most of these, by the way, are copies. The originals are stored safely in nearby museums. Since most of the statues on the church are from around the year 1400, we get a snapshot of Florence on the cusp between medieval and Renaissance. Start circling the church counterclockwise to the niche midway down the first side. In medieval times, statues were set deeply into church niches, simply embellishing the house of God. Here, we'll see how the statues, as restless as man on the verge of the Renaissance, were stepping away from the protection of the church. Stop at the niche containing four guys in robes, the Four Saints by Nanni di Bunco. These four early Christians were sculptors martyred by the Romans because they refused to sculpt pagan gods. They seemed to be contemplating the consequences of that fatal decision. Below the niche is a relief carving showing men at work. This is the symbol of the guild that paid for the art. Guilds were associations or labor unions of businessmen created to promote their trade. Art historians differ on which guild is depicted here. Some think the work was commissioned by the Carpenters and Masons Guild, Others contend it was by the guys who do discount circumcisions.
Oh, Rick.
Now compare these four placid statues with a work done a generation later, in the next niche to the right. St. George by Donatello, from around 1417, is alert. He's perched on the edge of his niche, scanning the horizon for dragons and announcing a new age with a new outlook. George has both feet planted firmly on the ground. His powerful right hand tenses as he prepares to attack. His furrowed brow shows there's a drama unfolding inside his head. Sure, he's anxious, but he's also self-assured. Comparing this Renaissance-style St. George to the four saints we just saw, you can psychoanalyze the heady changes underway as Florence enters the Renaissance. This is humanism. George, the Christian slayer of dragons, was just the sort of righteous warrior that proud Renaissance Florentines could rally around in their struggles with nearby cities. They adopted Donatello's George as the symbol of the city, just as they'd do a few generations later with Michelangelo's David.
Here's something else that was very influential. Just below the statue of George, check out the carved relief panel.
Donatello's relief shows St. George on a horse, doing what his statue had been planning, slaying the dragon.
The fair maiden he's saving is definitely in a classic damsel in distress pose.
Notice the shields to either side. These reminded everyone that this art was brought to you by the fine people in the Weapons Makers Guilds. Donatello was a master of reliefs,
having apprenticed with the great Ghiberti.
Though this relief may appear a bit underwhelming, art historians consider it to be a major breakthrough in realism. See how shallow the relief is, yet how much depth there appears to be. The horse is captured in full motion, with his tail blowing in the breeze. The damsel's graceful S-shaped body captured the same relaxed contrapposto stance found in so many ancient statues. And behind her is an arcade that recedes believably into the distance.
Ghiberti would be proud. Now, let's continue counterclockwise around the corner of the church to the backside, where you'll find the entrance to Or San Michele.
If the church is closed, as it often is, you can just skip to the next track and pick up the tour from there.
But if it's open, let's enter Or San Michele.
The Or San Michele interior. Here's a chance to step into Florence circa 1400. The fine altarpiece, or tabernacle, is by Orcagna. Notice how it was designed exactly for this space. Like the biggest Christmas tree possible, it's capped by an angel whose head just touches the ceiling. Notice the Gothic tabernacle's medieval elegance. What it lacks in depth and realism, it makes up for in color, with an intricate mix of marble, glass, gold, and expensive lapis lazuli. Florence had just survived the terrible bubonic plague of 1348, which killed half of its population. The elaborate tabernacle was built to display Bernardo Dadi's painting of the Virgin Mary. Plague survivors addressed their thanks to this Madonna della Grazia. While it's great to see art in museums, it's even better to enjoy it like this, in situ, exactly where the artist intended it. When you view similar altarpieces out of context in the various museums, think back on the candlelit medieval atmosphere that surrounds this glorious altarpiece.
Now, let's go back outside and see a few more of the statues that decorate the church exterior.
These groundbreaking statues serve as a kind of textbook showing the evolution of art in the 1400s.
From the church door, continue circling the exterior counterclockwise. As you round the corner to the south side, stop at the statue in the first niche, a statue of a robed saint.
Donatello's Saint Mark and other statues. The evangelist Mark cradles his gospel in his strong veined hand and gazes out. He rests his weight on his right leg while bending the left. This pose is called contrapposto, and this statue was the first to feature it since antiquity. Since it was commissioned by the Linen Sellers Guild, the statue excels in elaborately detailed robes that drape around the natural contours of St. Mark's body. Only after it was lifted into its niche did Donatello's cleverly designed proportions look right, and the guild accepted it. 80 years after young Donatello carved this statue, a teenaged Michelangelo stood right here and marveled. Donatello was the first great Renaissance sculptor. He mastered realism, creating the first truly lifelike statues of people since ancient times. In the true spirit of Renaissance humanism, Donatello appreciated the beauty of flesh and blood human beings. Donatello's brooding personality was also a model for later artists. He developed the role of mad genius that Michelangelo would later perfect.
Keep going, passing by the next niche to the statue after that.
As you make your way back to Via dei Calzaiuoli, you'll find a crude statue of a medieval-looking Madonna and Child, dating from 1399. This is the serene but unrealistic style that Renaissance artists were so ready to improve upon. The inscription reads that in 1493, a Jew who desecrated this statue was tortured and killed.
Continue on, circling the church counterclockwise to find a more sophisticated statue.
Rounding the corner back onto the busy main drag, you'll find a robed statue of St. John the Baptist dating from around 1415. It's by Lorenzo Ghiberti, the man who did the baptistry doors. This statue of the patron saint of Florence is considered the first freestanding bronze since antiquity, a triumph of metal casting technology that made Florentines proud of their know-how.
Finish up at the next niche with a statue from the late 1400s.
To the right stands Christ and Doubting Thomas by Verrocchio. Thomas just has to touch the wound in Jesus' side. With one foot in the heavenly niche and one in our real world, Thomas is one of us. Sculpted decades after Donatello and Ghiberti, in around 1480, this artwork has more motion, more emotion, and a full sense of the bodies under the heavy robes.
Let's move on. Continue walking south down Via dei Calzaiuoli.
By the way, if you'd like to see more sculpture, Florence's best collection is in the Bargello Museum. It's just a few blocks east of here. The Bargello has Donatello's original St. George. You'll also find the baptistry contest panels by Ghiberti and Brunelleschi, and some minor Michelangelos.
A minor Michelangelo?
True, but in art-heavy Florence, it's all relative.
Keep walking down the street.
The Bargello is a good reminder that Florence's Renaissance was first and foremost rooted in sculpture. Ghiberti pioneered 3D with his reliefs. Donatello fleshed it out with life-size statues. Then the torch of realism was passed to the next generation, Michelangelo.
Continue down the mall to our next stop.
You can't miss it.
It's the huge and historic square called Piazza Signoria.
The Piazza Signoria and the Palazzo Vecchio. The street opens up, and you emerge into an expansive square with one of the grandest views in all of Europe. Before you rises the Palazzo Vecchio, the city's town hall, both now and in times past. Florence prided itself on being a republic, ruled by a city council of elected citizens. They had no king and maintained a certain independence from the Pope in Rome. Of course, wealthy families like the Medici manipulated things, and the government worked for the interests of its merchant guilds, much as modern America caters to corporate interests. But Renaissance Florence was largely democratic and secular. As you enter the expansive Piazza Signoria, you're entering the political center of Florence. The piazza is dominated by the towering Palazzo Vecchio, with the marble greatness of Florence littering the cobbles. This square still vibrates with the echoes of Florence's past, executions, riots, and great celebrations. Today, the piazza is a tourist's world with pigeons, postcards, horse buggies, and tired hubbies.
As you absorb it all, start making your way through the square to the Palazzo Vecchio. We'll be taking a look at the palace as well as the big stone canopy to the right of it. First, head for the Palazzo Vecchio's main entrance, where there's a copy of Michelangelo's David.
The Palazzo Vecchio, or Old Palace, was the fortress-like city hall. In the early 1400s, this was where the city council met, but it eventually became the Medici's personal palace. The imposing building was designed to contain the city's riches and survive the many riots that went with local politics. The windows are just beyond the reach of angry stones. The tower was a handy lookout post, and justice was doled out sternly right on the square. Michelangelo's David once stood where the replica stands today, guarding the entrance. The original David was damaged in a 1527 riot when a bench was tossed out of a palace window and knocked his left arm off. In 1873, David was finally moved indoors for his own protection.
Let's take a quick look inside. Step past the fake David and enter the palace's courtyard. Make a full circuit around the courtyard.
As you stroll, enjoy this classic Renaissance space. Classic because it's classical, inspired by ancient Rome, with its round arches. The fanciful, confetti-like decor on the walls and ceilings was inspired by the decoration found in excavated ancient Roman villas.
Just keep strolling around the courtyard.
The statue in the middle, a cherub playing with a dolphin, was designed by Leonardo da Vinci's teacher. It was patterned after the kinds of whimsical fountains found in ancient villas. In fact, none of the motifs in this courtyard are religious. They're just playful and pretty. In those optimistic Renaissance times, they enjoyed art for art's sake, to make the world a little more delightful for the citizens of Florence. This was once Florence's civic center, and this is some of Europe's first public art. Such luxury was a big change 500 years ago.
Complete your circuit, making your way back to where we came in.
By the way, the scenes frescoed on the walls are of cities from the Germanic world, Vienna, Graz, Hall. They were painted to celebrate a German Grand Duchess marrying a Medici Duke. These scenes helped ease her homesickness.
Let's move on. Head back outside and turn left. You'll see the big, covered platform of statues called the Loggia.
This was originally a rostrum, where ordinary citizens could stand up and speak their piece, perfect for a city that prided itself on its democratic traditions. But later, when the Medici figured that good art was more desirable than free speech, it was turned into an outdoor sculpture gallery. Notice the squirming Florentine themes: conquest, dominance, rapes, and severed heads. The Rape of the Sabines shows a Roman warrior trampling a Sabine husband and carrying off the man's wife. The sculptor, Gian Bologna, proved his mastery of the medium by sculpting three entangled bodies from one piece of marble. With its pulse-quickening rhythm of muscles, it's considered mannerist from the restless period following the stately and confident Renaissance. It was done in around 1560. For the best angle, view it from below and in front, where you really appreciate the spiraling composition. The relief panel below shows a wider view of the terrible scene. Note what looks like an IV tube in the arm of the horrified husband. It's actually an electrified wire designed to keep the pigeons away.
Or those ancient Romans. Stroll a few paces to the left and find a dramatic statue of a famous beheading.
Benvenuto Cellini's Perseus, the Loggia's most noteworthy piece, shows the Greek hero who decapitated the snake-headed Medusa. They say Medusa was so ugly.
How ugly was she?
She turned humans who looked at her to stone. Talk about a bad hair day.
I know the feeling. Now cross the square to the big fountain of Neptune to the left of the Palazzo Vecchio.
So just to be clear, if you're facing the Palazzo Vecchio, it's the big statue just to the left. The huge statue that dominates the fountain shows the god of the sea rising above his entourage of nymphs, tritons, and dolphins. The figure is carved from a colossal block of Carrara marble. Florentines nicknamed him Il Biancone, the great white man.
The fountain by Bartolomeo Ammanati is impressive, though most Florentines, including Michelangelo, consider it a huge waste of marble.
Hey, I like it.
You would. The guy on the horse to the left is Cosimo I, not Cosimo the Elder who founded the dynasty, but one of the post-Renaissance Medici.
And if Cosimo and Neptune have the same expression, it's because Ammanati modeled the statue on the face of his patron, Cosimo.
Our next site is located about 10 steps in front of the fountain.
Uno, due, tre.
Now look down and find the round bronze plaque on the ground. This plaque marks the final episode in the tale of Savonarola.
Savonarola. After Lorenzo the Magnificent died in 1492, the Medici family was thrown from power by an austere monk named Savonarola. Railing against corrupt tyrants and sex predator popes, Savonarola returned Florence to a constitutional republic. But he also had a puritanical side. Savonarola organized huge rallies here on the square, lit by roaring bonfires. A charismatic speaker, he thundered against decadence and the secular humanism of the Renaissance. While children sang hymns, the devout brought their rich vanities, wigs, musical instruments, playing cards, even banned books and paintings, and tossed them into the flames. But not everyone wanted a return to the medieval past. Encouraged by the Pope and the exiled Medici, the Florentines fought back and arrested Savonarola. For 2 days, they tortured him inside the Palazzo Vecchio, trying to persuade him to see their side of things. Finally, they brought him to this very spot. The inscription on the bronze plaque begins in Italian, qui, here. Here on XXIII Maggio, that's the 23rd of May, they brought Savonarola and two of his monastic brothers, or fratelli. He was publicly defrocked and hanged. They built a bonfire, and on this very spot where Savonarola's followers had their bonfires to burn Renaissance vanities, the monk himself was set on fire. In many ways, this signaled the end of the Florentine Renaissance. The plaque commemorates the year in Roman numerals. Let's see. M, that's 1,000. CCCC, that makes 1,400. So Savonarola died in 1498. The Renaissance, having been born in Florence around 1400, now began migrating south to Rome and north to the rest of Europe.
We only have 200 yards to go, so hang in there.
Yeah, you mean like Savonarola?
Ha ha. Our next stop, the Uffizi, is back in the direction of the Loggia. So walk that way, past the fake David again, and go between the Palazzo Vecchio and the Loggia. You'll soon enter the courtyard of the horseshoe-shaped building called the Uffizi.
The Uffizi Courtyard, the Renaissance Hall of Fame. The top floor of this building, known as the Uffizi or offices during Medici days, is filled with the greatest collection of Florentine painting anywhere. Botticelli's Venus, works by Leonardo, Giotto, Michelangelo, and more. The collection traces the evolution of art from unrealistic gold-back medieval altarpieces to lifelike three-dimensional scenes featuring pagan goddesses and Renaissance centerfolds. If that sounds interesting, check out our audio tour of the Uffizi Museum. The Uffizi Courtyard is often jam-packed with tourists waiting to get into the museum. It's watched over by 19th-century statues of the great figures of the Renaissance. These Florentines virtually invented our modern world, so let's pay tribute to them as we stroll through the Hall of Fame of Florence.
Start by finding the first statue. It's on the left, actually tucked under the arcade, next to a doorway. It shows a man in a robe with a snazzy pageboy haircut. Read the label on the pedestal.
It's Lorenzo il Magnifico, Lorenzo the Magnificent, the Medici family's great art patron and cunning power broker. Excelling in everything except modesty, he set the tone for the Renaissance.
Start walking down the courtyard to the next statue on your left. By the way, I heard that Lorenzo the Magnificent's girlfriends called him Larry the Mediocre.
Continuing down the Uffizi courtyard, you'll next find the statue of Giotto. As an architect, he holds the plan to the city's great bell tower, which was named for him. But he was also considered the first great modern painter.
Boy, you were right earlier. He was the ugliest man of the 14th century.
Next, find the sculptor Donatello holding his trusty hammer and chisel. His lifelike statues on Giotto's tower and Or San Michele inspired Michelangelo.
And up ahead is the man who set the tone for Renaissance painting.
Leon Battista Alberti wrote a famous book called On Painting, which taught early Renaissance artists the mathematics of perspective.
Coming up is a man who could do it all. He grew up in Florence and went on to spread his talents around Italy and France.
That would be Leonardo da Vinci, the ultimate Renaissance man. Scientist, sculptor, musician, engineer, and hey, not a bad painter either.
Leonardo actually crossed paths with our next famous Florentine when they both designed murals for the Palazzo Vecchio.
Michelangelo ponders the universe, or is he stifling a belch? His famous statue of David is just the beginning. As a sculptor, painter, architect, and deep-thinking poet, Michelangelo took Florentine Renaissance values and popularized them in Rome and beyond.
Michelangelo's work as a poet was inspired by the first great Italian writer just ahead.
Dante, with the laurel leaf crown and lyre of a poet, seems to say, "I am the father of the Italian language." He was, because he was the first Italian to write a popular work, the Divine Comedy, in non-Latin, using the Florentine dialect, which soon became standard Italian throughout the country.
Dante's poetic language was passed on to the next generation of writers, our next two statues.
The poet Petrarch wears laurel leaves from Greece, a robe from Rome, and a belt from, looks like Walmart to me.
I'm not sure even Walmart would sell a headdress like Petrarch's, unless it was in the women's section.
Petrarch was a strong influence on our next figure.
Yeah, in fact, they wear the same outfit.
Boccaccio wrote the Decameron, stories told to pass the time during the 1348 bubonic plague.
Next up is a man rubbing his chin, deep in thought.
The devious-looking Machiavelli is hatching a plot. His book, The Prince, taught that the end justifies the means, paving the way for the slick and cunning Machiavellian politics of today.
Keep going down the courtyard, veering toward the left corner. The statue there is a reminder that Florence also led the way in science.
Amerigo Vespucci was an explorer and mapmaker who gave his name to a fledgling new world.
Now cross to the right for one of the greatest men of science. Though he wasn't born in Florence, his work was sponsored by enlightened Florentine rulers.
That would be Galileo in the other corner. Galileo holds the humble telescope he used to spot the moons of Jupiter. He's more famous, though, as the bold scientist who defied church dogma. It was Galileo who popularized the radical notion that the Earth is not the center of the universe.
It's not?
Incredibly, no. The Earth revolves around the sun.
Huh. You learn something new every day. Let's continue our walk to the Arno River. Exit the courtyard at the far end. The river is just up ahead.
You'll need to cross a street to get to the river. Be sure to look carefully both ways. When you reach the river, you're treated to wonderful views.
But let's enjoy those views as we walk. Turn right, start walking toward the bridge, and listen as Rick describes the river and the bridge, known as the Ponte Vecchio.
The Arno River and view of the Ponte Vecchio. The Arno River runs east to west, the same direction you're walking. It starts in the Apennine Mountains that form the spine of Italy. 150 miles later, it spills out into the Mediterranean near Pisa. The Arno's level varies dramatically from a trickle to a torrent, but most of that is now controlled by dams upstream. Visitors gaze at the lazy river and have a tough time imagining it being a destructive giant. But rare, powerful flooding was a part of life in Florence. The Arno washed away the Ponte Vecchio in 1333, and on November 4, 1966, a huge rain turned the Arno into a wall of water, inundating the city with mud stacked as high as 20 feet. Even as far inland as the Duomo, the water was 6 feet high. Dozens died, nearly 14,000 families were left homeless, and a huge amount of art was lost or damaged. Nowadays, kayakers glide peacefully on the river, sightseers enjoy the bridge, and locals still get nervous when it rains.
Continue walking along the river as you get good views of the bridge known as the Ponte Vecchio.
Before you is the Ponte Vecchio, or Old Bridge. It's made of stone and lined with shops. A bridge has spanned this narrowest part of the Arno since Roman times. It was built where the east-west axis of river trade met the north-south axis of the main highway from northern Europe to Rome. Even when Rome fell, Florence really didn't. It remained a bustling trade center along the river right through medieval times. After a flood washed away the old wooden bridge, this one was built in 1345. The shops were originally inhabited by butchers and hide tanners, a natural fit because they could empty their waste directly into the river below. Looking closely at the bridge, you'll see a row of windows running across the top, above the shops. Those windows are for an elevated passageway that crosses the bridge. It's known as the Vasari Corridor. Built by the Medici, this led from the Palazzo Vecchio, through the Uffizi, across the Ponte Vecchio, to their home in the immense Pitti Palace, 4 blocks beyond the bridge. In less secure times, the Medici used this as a fortified passageway in case of attack. During normal times, it was just a pleasant commute to the office.
By now, you should be approaching the entrance to the bridge. Our tour will end on the bridge, so take a moment to get your bearings. If you turned right at the bridge, down Via Por Santa Maria, that would take you back into the center of town. But we'll turn left, onto the bridge.
The Ponte Vecchio. Stroll up the bridge towards the center. You'll pass shops on either side selling gold and silver jewelry to wide-eyed tourists. It's clear that the stinky medieval trade has gone upscale. In the 16th century, the butchers were replaced by the gold and silver merchants. The Florence of today is not all Renaissance and tourism. It's a bustling city of 400,000 people, with lots of professionals, a prestigious university, and it's recognized as a capital of high fashion.
When you reach the middle of the bridge, pause and take in your surroundings. Looking up, you'll have close-up views of the Vasari Corridor. Next, look on the right side of the bridge for a small statue.
At the central point of the bridge is a fine bust of one of Florence's greatest metalworkers, the goldsmith and sculptor Benvenuto Cellini. It was Cellini who did the statue of Perseus and Medusa that we saw back at the loggia. Looking up and downstream, you enjoy timeless views of the city. The neighborhood across the river, known as Oltrarno, is more rustic, working class, well worth exploring. The other bridges are all modern replacements. During World War II, the German commander was instructed to blow up all the bridges to cover the Nazi retreat. But even some Nazis appreciate history. He blew up the others, but left the Ponte Vecchio impassable, but intact. Grazie. The Ponte Vecchio is molto romantico, especially in the evening. The sun sets behind the hills, the bridges cast their reflection on the flat water. Street musicians play, and lovers hold hands. The city of Florence, born in Roman times, flourishing right through the Middle Ages, and blossoming in the Renaissance, remains a vibrant city still. One of Europe's cultural capitals. We hope you've enjoyed this Renaissance walk through Florence. Thanks to Jean Openshaw, the co-author of this tour. If you're up for more sightseeing, we have other audio tours available for the Uffizi Museum and for the Academia with Michelangelo's David. Remember, this tour was excerpted from the Rick Steves Florence and Tuscany Guidebook, co-authored with Jean Openshaw. For more details on eating, sleeping, and sightseeing in Florence, refer to this year's edition of that guidebook. For more free audio tours and podcasts, and for information about our TV shows, bus tours, and travel gear, visit our website at ricksteves.com. This tour was produced by Cedar House Audio Productions. Grazie.
Arrivederci.
And buon viaggio.